This is the Auto Body Podcast, presented by Clarity Code. We'll get stories and talk to people from all over the industry. Painters, body guys, manufacturers, and anybody in between. Let's do it. Welcome to the Auto Body Podcast.
Auto Body Podcast.
Presented by Clarity Code. Now, here's your host, Adam Huber.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. Today, I am very, very excited. I know I say that about every episode, but like this one's, I feel like, pretty special. Today, we have Ted Williams from Sharpsburg, Georgia, the Global Director of Business Services for Sherwin-Williams. And crazily enough, I don't know if you guys know this guy, but he's been around for a little while. He's been a part of Sherwin-Williams for 30 years. So really looking forward to getting some insight as to how someone can stick around in the industry for that long and his story of the industry. So, Ted, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Adam. How about yourself?
I'm doing great, man. Doing great. So why don't you go ahead and start us off from the beginning? What was young Ted like? How did he get into cars, or was it just paint, or how did you get on this crazy road?
Well, I've been around this industry my entire life. I'm actually would be third generation in the automotive industry. My grandfather actually did collision repair and auto service. My dad was a body man and shop manager at different times, and I actually painted my first car when I was 11 years old. Painted a 1964 Pontiac Catalina, a two-door sedan, and had to stand on a five-gallon bucket to be able to reach the top of the car. So that tells you how...
Do you think OSHA would approve of that now?
Well, I don't think OSHA would approve of it. You know, there's a difference between child labor from back then, I guess.
It didn't exist.
That's the difference.
Okay, so 11 years old, painted your first vehicle, and did you just kind of fall in love with the process at that point?
Well, since I was around the industry, and my dad had a shop by the time I was in middle school and high school, and I worked in the shop, and a lot of time during that period, I would actually come in after school and paint the cars that needed to be painted. So him and his team would do most of the body work. I would come in the evening and paint cars, and so I've painted a lot of cars during those years. And it kind of led me into the path that I got involved with the collision repair program in high school and participated in VICA, which is now Skills USA. And in high school, I actually won the state championship in Alabama twice and competed in national competition. And then it earned me a scholarship to get my first 2 years of college done. I went to the community college, offered me a scholarship for the collision program, and I said, look, the only way I'm going to come here and compete in the collision program and participate in your school is if I can take academic classes as well. So I actually got my first 2 years of college while I was taking a collision program, and during college I won the state championship at the college level twice and then placed as high as second in the U.S. in Skills USA back then. So it kind of got me started on it. I got my I earned a scholarship to finish my bachelor's degree because of my activities around that. And after I left, after I graduated college, I ended up having an opportunity to come to work for Sherwin-Williams. It was the middle of a recession, kind of like some of the things that we talk about today. The only difference is back then during this recession, nobody was hiring. So
did you say what year this was approximately?
are you asking me? Okay, so that was that was around 1992. I was applying for a lot of jobs, and then ultimately I ended up getting called back from a gentleman at the time who was the regional manager for Acme Automotive Finishes, which was a brand that we had for Sherwin-Williams back in those days that were sold through warehouse distributors. And I went in for the interview and I ended up getting the job. And he told me later that he had over 80 applicants for the job and that he ended up picking me because he had actually sponsored me in the collision competitions, my travel, and had remembered me when I was in those programs. So that was the start of my career at Sherwin-Williams. And during that 30 years, I think I've worked in or managed almost every role inside Sherwin-Williams Company all the way up to the level I'm in now. So I've actually run our stores. I've actually been a tech rep. I've been a national account rep, area manager, a national account manager, director of sales, and now on the marketing side. So I've worked in just about every role inside the company as well.
Wow. So safe to say that you're a bit of a winner, winning all these VICA and Skills USA competitions and everything. The thing I'd like to back up to real quick is you had mentioned that you were painting these cars at night in your dad's shop, right?
That's correct. Yes.
Okay. What was that atmosphere or environment like where, you know, they have a young teenage kid coming in and painting these cars, and I'm assuming it's adults doing the work. Like, did they know about it? How did they feel about it? Did you have to prove yourself? What was that like?
Back at that particular time, I don't think I had as much of an issue with it because I think it was kind of a situation of none of the people in the shop wanted to paint. So they were happy to pass it off to anybody else. That was back in the days when a lot of shops had what we would call combination men. They did their own body work and painting. And when they had an opportunity back then that somebody could just do the painting, and frankly, it wasn't cutting into their money because I wasn't being paid to do it, they didn't have a problem with it. So I didn't really have an issue with it that time. But, you know, to the point of what you're making about acceptance and someone new coming into the industry, I did kind of face that a little bit when I first started with Sherwin-Williams.
I just want to ask the question about working in the shop, and then we'll get to the Sherwin-Williams part. But why was painting kind of like not the thing that people wanted to do back then versus now? It seems like, you know, if you're the painter, you know, you got it going on.
Well, back in that time period, I would say that the painting process was a lot more laborious than it is today. You know, when I first started off, we were still doing a lot of work with acrylic lacquer. So you were essentially adding a lot of different coats. You were having to wait between coats for it to flash correctly. You were having to later on sand and buff and polish everything. So it was a lot of labor involved with actually doing stuff back then. You know, it's an entirely different process. Occasionally you would end up doing an overall paint job using acrylic enamel or acrylic urethane, but you know, in those situations, you know, when you're doing an overall job and you're doing, say, a single stage, there's a lot more opportunity to mess something up as well. It's kind of an art of being able to get the metallic straight and everything in that time period. So in those particular cases with the technicians that we were dealing with, they didn't particularly want to do it because they were afraid if they messed something up, they would have to redo it, and they didn't want to have to mess with it. So I was pretty comfortable of doing the work, and I was very good at it. So I frankly had very few redos that I ever had to do. So I got very comfortable doing it.
Very nice. What were these competitions for VICA like? Were they have any laid on pearls and metallics and everything like that, and they would check how even it was, or, you know, stuff like that, or what the finish was? Like, what were these competitions like?
Well, the competition back then is a little bit different from what it is today. I just recently had the opportunity to go back to the first national contest I'd been to since I competed. And now they've kind of separated the contest out. So there's like a refinish competition, there's an estimation competition and damage analysis, and then there's a collision body repair competition. Back in that day, we did it all. And it was probably the longest. That contest, of all the contests they did in skills competition, and keep in mind they did masonry, electricity, everything, all these other skill competitions, ours was the first one to start and the last one to end. And we did, we had everything from doing frame setup and analysis to writing an estimate to doing various welding and cutting with welding equipment to dent repair and also painting. So we did a little bit of all of it. So, and it was all condensed in pretty much one day. So you were, when you left at the end of the day, you were exhausted because it was a constant race because you were timed the entire time you were doing it as well. So
I'm just imagining the estimating part being you have your clipboard, you look at the car, and you're like, yep, it's screwed. Okay.
Well, back then we had to actually write it with manuals. So you had estimating manuals you had to use. So a lot of times you have an estimator goes out and they just looked and said, okay, it needs a fender, it needs a bumper cover, and then they kind of drill down into what they need. Back then, I think we had to work more by groups, because the way the manuals were, if you just started doing it the way you do today and click stuff, you'd be searching back and forth all day long. But back then, you would actually start with a bumper group, and you'd analyze the bumper group all the way down. Then you would, and that's how you would actually do it, because that kept you from having to flip back and forth in the book the whole time as you're trying to assess the damage. So, but it was a different process because it was all handwritten. And you could see in the competition, you'd have someone from a professional writer that would come in and write the estimate, and we're supposed to write an estimate that's the closest to that. And you would see ranges across the board of what you would see in that estimate just because of the experience of the people writing them.
Interesting. So did you have like an hour per section or, you know, category or whatever?
Well, they were different times for each one, but if I remember correctly, of course, you remember this is 30 something years ago.
I expect you to remember it perfectly, so please.
Yeah, I think so. I think it was for the estimating portion was about an hour. Some of the sessions would be a little bit longer, but the contest transitioned just in the 4 years I competed at Nationals. It went from the first year we were actually doing welding with oxygen acetylene torches. We were doing brazing and welding with oxygen acetylene torches. But the fourth year I was competing, we were MIG welding and plasma cutting. So that's how much that changed in just the four-year period that I competed in that competition. And we started from, we were using lacquer to using base coat clear coat by the time I finished as well. So we talk about the rapid changes that happen in the industry today, and we are having a lot of rapid changes, but that was a pretty fast change in the industry right there in about a 4 or 5 year period where everything was changing from the tools that you use to fix the cars to the products you're using on top of them.
Interesting. Okay, so you had kind of mentioned, you know, you transitioned from college and you started Sherwin-Williams, and you know, there's some acceptance that has to go on. Is that because what were you doing in that role that you needed to, you know, basically kind of prove yourself to your peers?
Well, my first job with Sherwin was a sales job. So I was a sales rep and I was 22 years old. So it's funny, we're talking about this because actually my son now works for Sherwin-Williams as a technical rep, and he's roughly about the age that I was when I started with Sherwin. So I had some similar conversation to him when he started his job about what I had to do back then. But what would happen is I would go out as a sales rep at 22 years old, and I would walk in a shop, and I'm calling on an owner of a shop or a manager of a shop who was the same age as my dad. And they would look at me, and the first thing they would say is that, what is this young kid going to be able to do for me as a sales rep? And I felt like at times I was getting dismissed because of my age coming in here. It had nothing to do with my experience, because if I could get in front of them and actually show them, they would be astonished that a 22-year-old kid was able to do what they were doing. But it was kind of an age acceptance as far as credibility. So what I did back then is I made a decision that I need to find a way of providing value to these people that they'll be able to accept and that I can actually build some credibility with them. So I started looking at what I could do. So one of the things is I went ahead and got myself certified so I could actually put the patches and things on my jacket, so at least when I was walking in a shop, they would at least see that this 22-year-old kid is a certified technician, so maybe they're not just coming in here and going to blow stuff up when they're showing me something. But then I also started looking at what opportunities I could do to help them become better and improve their business. And that particular time frame is when DRP's programs were just beginning to kick off. And shops were looking at opportunities to get on DRP programs, mainly at that point, because it's just going to be easier for them to handle the claim. They didn't have all the adjusters involved in the process. So I started looking at it, and one of the things that a lot of these people struggle, because I go back to the point, they were my dad's age. They didn't grow up around computers. They didn't grow up around technology. And that's still in the early 90s. It was still the early days of technology anyway. Is I started doing things like building them, helping them build their value presentation and things like, and building it in a new tool like PowerPoint, and going out and actually helping present that to these insurance companies on behalf of them to get them on the program. And I quickly started earning a reputation in the marketplace that if you want to be on a DRP program, you need to get this kid to go in here with you, because they're going to help you put all your stuff together that you need to present the value of you being part of that program. And then he's going to be able to help you stand alongside you and present it so you can get on the program. So it quickly transformed the trajectory of what I was doing in my job, because I found something of value to them that I could provide that they weren't getting somewhere else.
Just out of curiosity, what was the thing that when you're trying to become DRP approved, what were the qualifications that these companies are looking for primarily to approve or not approve someone?
You mean back at that period of time?
Yep.
Back at that period of time, they were looking at things like capacity. Do you have the capacity to take on the work? You know, if we send it to you, can the work get processed and get processed in a quick enough cycle time to be beneficial to us? They were looking at things like repair order accuracy. Are you going to be able to? Is there going to be this honesty and transparency in the way we're writing these tickets and giving them back and forth? Because that, keep in mind, that was also a time where we were transitioning from shops writing things from manuals to go into computers to write it. And so there was a lot of distrust going on that people might not be writing things correctly. So those were two of the things in particular they were looking for at that time.
Okay, interesting. So you really got your foothold and got a lot of your respect by giving value first, and then gain that respect from those shops. Mm-hmm. And I mean, from there, it must have just been easy street, right? No,
yeah.
No resistance after that, right?
No, I think every day is always, every day that you deal is always a challenge. But one thing I've set out upon doing of years ago, and I've always stuck to this, is making sure that I learn something new every day and recognizing what I learned. Now, some of the lessons are lessons that you enjoy, and some of them are lessons that you don't enjoy. But what I try to do is, as the day comes to an end, I try to sit back and reflect on what happened that day and what did I learn from the experience that I have. And I think because of that, it's helped me to actually have this continuous improvement process in my mind, that I'm always looking for a better way of doing things or a better way of improving myself and the customers that I deal with. So it's helped me kind of drive my entire career that way. And that's one of the things that even when I work with people that are new in this industry and I try to get them started, I try to focus on the fact of having that continuous improvement mentality and understanding your own strengths and weaknesses in order to be effective.
Are you journaling these things, or are you just simply sitting back and just thinking about the day, like taking a half hour to yourself and just thinking back on the day?
I think it's more personal reflection than it is journaling. It would have been interesting if I'd actually journaled this over the years and been able to look and see all the different things that I'd seen, but I have a pretty good memory, so you know, we've just been talking about things that happened 35 years ago, so yeah. I tend to remember a lot of the things that I deal with, but and I think part of it is because I continue to reinforce it in my mind of the different challenges and opportunities that I've had.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, for the guys listening to the podcast, they'll probably poo-poo the idea of journaling and everything like that, but man, think about being able to grab the books off the shelf from 70 to 71, or you know, whatever it might be. Well, let's just say like 92 to 93, yeah. 93 to 94, and look back on these daily reflections of, like, you know, here's the things that I encountered, and here's what I how I overcame it, and here's what I think I could do better next time. Just just some simple stuff like that, man, that would make for some crazy good information for a person, anyone to read getting into any sort of industry. Because yeah, I'm gonna fluff your ego a little bit here, but I think it's well deserved. Reading those kinds of insights from people like yourself, where you have worked your way from here in the industry all the way up to global director of business services, I mean, there is something to learn there. Mm-hmm. Like, and you know, that is one of the reasons why doing this podcast, I think, is actually really beneficial for a lot of people, because what people don't realize is that this is going to stick around for forever. Mm-hmm. And the lessons that you or anyone else has, there are people that 10 years from now, they might be a different platform that this is on, but they're going to be able to learn from. And if they take these ideas and implement them in their own lives are going to get improved. So it would have been just awesome to read back on some of those reflections. Mm-hmm. So going back, so I mentioned, you know, you've kind of worked your way up through this industry. I'm really curious, what was probably the most difficult job that you had, you know, out of all these different hats that you've worn, what was probably the more difficult one for you?
Well, I think at one point, probably being a sales director was probably one of the more difficult ones. And I think I say that because I had responsibility for an organization that was probably over 200 people working for me. And you were dealing everything from store staffing issues all the way up to sales reps and sales opportunities and customer issues. So it took a lot of balancing of that as you're trying to work through the day to be able to accomplish what you're trying to do. But one of the things I learned from that is that if you're going to be effective when you have a large organization like that, is you have to create culture. You have to have the right kind of training in place. You have to have the right kind of support in place, the right kind of encouragement in place with your people. And I think it helped me at that point as I discovered that I needed to have a very open door policy with my people. I tried to be less hierarchical in the way I did stuff. So I would, you know, if a sales rep needed to talk to me, I didn't wait for them. They didn't have to go through their manager to come to me to talk. And my management team also knew that if some of those people came directly to me, that I wasn't going to penalize them or hold them accountable for their people coming direct. I felt that if I've got to instill a culture, that having that access was a key piece to being successful. So that was probably one of the it was struggling, but it was a great learning opportunity as well.
I find that really interesting. What year frame are we talking about right here where you had that job? About what?
That would have probably been in the early 2000s, somewhere around 2002 through about 2006 or 7 or 8, something like that.
The reason why I asked about that was because the word culture got thrown around a lot from mid teens of the 2000s to, you know, probably now. And there's a lot of talk about how culture is what the younger generations really care about and everything like that. And I think what happens is that a lot of these companies see that word or hear that word and immediately think that people are wanting beanbag lobby chairs or, you know, a pizza bar or an espresso bar or whatever, just this really over the top stuff. And you're talking about a time when, you know, this is a little bit before that kind of conversation was happening. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, you're using the word culture, and what were some specific, I mean, you kind of said that you had an open door policy, but what were some of these things that you were doing back then that improved the environment and the culture of the company?
I think it goes back, and I don't think it's any different now, because it's all in human nature. Is the most valuable thing you can give somebody is your time. Mm-hmm. And you know, you talk about things, you know, it's great to have a pizza party or recognition or thing, you know, different things like that. But what I find people most appreciate is when you're willing to give your own time to them, to sit down to them, to listen to them, to allow them to share with you where their thoughts are, to brainstorm with them around things to help them be better. And that's kind of what I focused on then. And that's, frankly, that's what I focus on today. You know, we found that and through a lot of the training we do at Sherwin-Williams, our most effective training is when we actually do one-on-one coaching. And that's the things that people get most appreciate. You know, if in the busyness of the day, you know, we're slammed with emails and phone calls and everything else, and it's easy that you can go out to work with a sales rep that you jump it, you pick them up, they pick you up at the airport, and you jump in the car in the passenger seat, and you immediately pick up your phone and start returning all the phone calls that you missed when you were on the plane. But you forget that you had this great one-on-one windshield time right there with them where you could be giving them some dedicated time, and that's where they really get the most value out of it. So when I went back to the culture piece, as I started myself and with my management team, is making sure that we actually set time aside with our people to actually talk to them, understand what challenges they were dealing with, also understand what their career objectives were and what they were trying to accomplish. And I say this beyond just a normal performance appraisal timeline. You know, you get that once a year performance appraisal. If a sales rep or an employee of yours hears about something at the performance appraisal that they haven't heard all year, that's not a very good process. You should be talking about things on a regular cadence, and when you get to a point of a performance appraisal, it's just essentially recapping what you've already been talking about all year. So that's where I think the real piece is that giving the time and the energy and the efforts to people is where the real value comes from.
Yeah, I agree. It's really shocking what just listening to people and giving them your full attention really does for people. You know, do you know who Simon Sinek is by chance?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
Okay. I didn't want to assume anything, so I'm sorry. I didn't mean for that to be insulting. But Simon Sinek has this really great talk where he talks about how, you know, we have this device right here, the phone. And what people will do when they're having dinners or meetings or whatever is they take the phone and then they just put it right on top of the table, but they do it face down. Mm-hmm. And that's supposed to mean, hey, you know, you've got my full attention now. But that phone is still right there. Mm-hmm. And it's such a powerful part of our daily lives right now that he's like, well, you know, if you're willing to put it on the table and you're willing to have it on silent, why not just have it in your pocket? Because it's out of sight, out of mind type of situation there. And doing just those, and I'm guilty of this, I'm not great at it, I'm definitely not preaching at all here, but there is something really powerful about when, you know, a phone call comes in or whatever and it's in your pocket and you just simply reach down and hit mute and you keep your eyes on that person the entire time you're talking. There's something pretty powerful about that. Or, you know, you're having a one-on-one time with someone in a shop. Someone comes off from the side, tries to interrupt you, and you say, hey, I'm talking right now with this person. I'll be over there in a minute. And you keep to that. Mm-hmm. You go over to that person, and you have another one-on-one time with them, right? Mm-hmm. It's hard. It's brutal. It can be difficult to do because of what you just said. There's tons of emails coming in. You got 100 fires behind you and stuff like that. But allowing that time for a one-on-one time or for one-on-one, I think you're absolutely right. Just creates a really great environment and expectation from people.
Yeah, I would tell you that my wife would probably say this is a continuous improvement area that I have to keep working on as well. But but I think part of it is being cognizant of it. You know, I've tried to focus on there is to make sure I'm cognizant that when something like this is going, is just stop, you know, and focus on it. And it kind of reminded me of a story when I first started with Sherwin. Back then, we didn't have cell phones. We had pagers. I don't know if you remember that. That might be before your day.
That was before my time.
But I was working with another sales rep who was actually leading the region in sales calls. And we go to get in the car, and he says, let me show you the secret to my success. And I said, what's that? He takes the pager, unclips it from his belt, turns it off, and clips it to the visor in the car, and he says that's not coming back on until at least 3 o'clock this afternoon.
Interesting.
And it kind of led me to think through this. And later on, when I was a sales manager, one of the things I started doing with my people is I started a little thing. I started calling it First Things First, but essentially what I would do is that I would have them make all their prospect calls in the morning and their customer calls in the afternoon. And they, by doing that, they increased their call volume. They were more effective in their calls, because what happened is a lot of times they would get tied up in things in the morning and spend more time in a place than it was necessary. And so I started trying to focus on doing that. And part of that whole piece was get up in the morning and start making your calls, but shut the phone down until you get the first part of your work done. And it was very effective from that standpoint. Now, anytime you do something like that, it takes a lot of conversation. You have to make sure your customers are aware of what you're doing and you have a service support plan in place, because there are always going to be emergencies and things that come up. But to your point, you know, sometimes it's that you have to prioritize certain things. And going back to what we were talking about a minute ago, is that one-on-one time, it's where you have to prioritize.
Yeah. What leadership challenges did you experience in that role where, I'm sorry, I forgot the title, but where you were overseeing director of sales?
That's correct.
The sales director?
Mm-hmm.
Where you're overseeing a team of people, what were some leadership challenges that you encountered with that?
Well, I think one of the biggest challenges, you got to have the right kind of people on the team. You know, it goes back to the old book, if you read it years ago, Good to Great, and it talks about having the right people in the right seat on the bus.
Yep.
And that's a critical piece of this, because here's the thing, is if you're trying to build a certain culture and you put somebody into a management role in your team that doesn't align with that culture, it's going to be very difficult for you to be successful. So if you have somebody that's a very strong top-down manager and it's his way or the highway, and you're trying to create an engagement culture where people are involved in decisions and they are have ownership in what they're doing, that may not gel correctly in the culture that you're doing. So probably the biggest challenge is just making sure you got the right people in the right seat as you get started. And I think that's where a lot of people struggle, and this is a big struggle today in particular, because we're in the middle of a labor shortage. We're trying our best just to get bodies to go into roles just so we can get things done. And so in some situations, we may be making decisions and putting wrong people in roles because we're trying to patch a hole rather than looking at things strategically. But we have to think about that as we're doing some of these things, is it going to hurt the rest of the business? Because you may be plugging this hole and in turn create a crack in the dam somewhere else because people don't like the culture that person's bringing.
Yeah. I guess on that note, do you have any solutions or thoughts or anything like that to this labor shortage problem? What do you foresee happening in the next 5-10 years?
Well, there's a couple of different things I think we can look at, and I'm always one that we can look at things that are wider industry problems, but we also have to look at things that we can actually have more control over. And one of the things I think we have more control over is labor optimization, labor utilization. And I look at a lot of shops, and you go in and you see touch time numbers where there is 2 hours a day or 2.5 hours a day of touch time where they're actually physically touching a vehicle. And you think to yourself, what if we could just improve that by an hour or 2 hours? Would that help with some of the skilled labor issues that we have if your technicians were more efficient? And when I say more efficient, I don't mean working them harder, because everybody, you know, the technician has a life and they want to have a good work-life balance. But are there things that we created in the process that's doing this? For example, are we bringing cars into the shop that haven't been fully damaged, assessed? And are parts missing, critical parts they need that we don't have? And then all of a sudden we're moving cars around, or they're starting and stopping. And are we having technicians having to go search for cars in the parking lot and things like that? So there's a lot of steps from a process, operational process standpoint, we can do to have the labor be more effective. So that's one. But the other thing, I think, from a greater industry problem is, how do we make the industry appealing? we're still kind of stereotyped as an industry. I laugh about this, but it's really not funny, is that my wife and I can watch a television show and you can see a crime boss or something, or a crime significant, and they, where they go when they're meeting each other, they're meeting at the body shop. I actually was talking to somebody recently, and I told them what I was in around the industry, and they said, wow, that's got to be interesting. You must deal with a lot of criminals every day. And it's because on the way it's depicted on television is that it's this dirty back of the woods place, and it's no semblance at all to what we actually have today when you go into a collision center. So part of it is we've got to change the way we present the image to the industry, or to people in general. But we also need to go back and start investing in vocational education. I was astonished. I was looking the other day, like the state of Alabama, where I was, had gone through the program when I was in that age, they're down to maybe just a handful of collision programs in the entire state now.
Wow.
But it's not just collision. You know, some of these schools used to have carpentry and plumbing and electrical and air conditioning, refrigeration, all these different types of trades, and they have none of them anymore. They've now, everything they're teaching is IT related or cybersecurity related or things like that. They've shifted their vocational focus more toward the IT side and less away from the skilled trades. And so it's not something that we just deal with in the collision industry, but it's a skilled trades issue everywhere. Yeah. But I think part of it is that people don't realize where the income opportunities are in this industry. You know, you have a lot of people in this world that are working, and we talk about things about raising the minimum wage. There are a lot of people that are working jobs that if they knew that they could go and become an apprentice or learn this skill, it would be life transforming for them to be able to go into a job that pays what we pay technicians and managers in this industry.
Yeah, I think we have actually talked about this quite a bit on the show, where we talk about what needs to change and the attitude change from blue collar, white collar type jobs. And I'll be honest with you, Ted, I'm actually pretty optimistic that the blue collar industries, whatever you want to label that as, are actually going to make a pretty big comeback. Mm-hmm. And I think that vocational and high school programs like shop class are going to make a comeback, because there's something, you're right, there is a lot of emphasis on IT, there's a lot of emphasis in medical. However, there's also a lot of ugliness about those industries out there and being talked about on social media in general. You know, so as an example, yeah, you could go be a nurse. Good luck with your 18-hour shifts and, you know, 24 overnights and your messed up sleep schedule and everything like that, right? So there's that part of it, along with, you know, they get paid like crap, but yet a traveling nurse, just because she's got the word travel right in front of her name, makes three times as much money. So there's that. And then you look at IT and tech jobs, there is so much volatility in IT and tech jobs. I have a brother-in-law who's in IT. He does security, information technology. His companies, or the people that he's worked for, in the 8 years that I've known him, I think he's been bought out 4 or 5 times. Imagine as a body shop guy getting bought out 4 or 5 times in 8 years. And the amount of inefficiencies and hurdles and resistance and all this kind of stuff. You guys might hate your boss now. Imagine dealing with a new boss every year and a half, 2 years.
Well, not just new boss, but a new company culture.
And yeah,
everything's different.
You think you're upset now? Wait till your pizza party. They changed from Domino's to Pizza Hut. Like, it's a totally different thing. Like, we can't be having this. Yeah. So I think what's going to happen is there's going to be information that comes out. I've talked about this ad nauseum on the podcast before. I think what's going to happen is people are going to look at blue collar industries, carpentry, electrical, plumbing, auto body, mm-hmm. mechanics. And they're going to say, hey, you know, like I can make just as much, if not more money in those fields. And yeah, you know, sure. Like I get a little dirty, I have to work a little hard, but I don't have to deal with getting bought out every other year, or I don't have to worry about working over. Well, I mean, I'm sure there's some painters or some body guys out there that have worked a couple of overnights, but that's not the standard, right? That's what's expected of you. Plus, you know, you don't have to deal with delivering babies or somebody chopping their leg off and having to deal with that with medical. But yeah, I agree with you. I think it starts off at schools. I think that you bring back shop class. It ignites something in those kids because they get to use their hands, mm-hmm. and they get to make something. Mm-hmm. And there is something to, there's something deep down within us that is extraordinarily rewarding versus typing away some code and then hitting enter and being like, oh, look at that, I have a start button now. Like it's just not the same thing.
Well, I think where the opportunity also could be in this industry too is around building apprenticeship programs.
Yes.
Because if we, you know, for example, if we're trying to be dependent on vocational schools that aren't getting the money invested in that they need to be successful, and then we have to find another way of doing it, and apprenticeship programs is a key way to do it. That's more of the European model of how they would go about training and developing there. And I think it has a good fit because, you know, the other piece in this industry is, you know, we're getting to the point that the average technician in the body repair industry is in their mid-40s.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the average. Now, we've had a lot of retirements in the past few years during COVID, but it's not unusual to go into a shop today and find a 60-year-old body man. And yeah. Without saying my age, we've talked a little bit about how long I've been in the industry. I don't know that.
Well, yeah, you're probably only like 40.
No, well, I mean. I'm a little bit older than that, but not to the 60s by any means. But it takes a lot of wear. As you get older, it takes a lot of wear and tear on your body when you're in these shops every day doing this. So yeah. Part of what we should probably be looking at more as an industry is that whole apprenticeship piece and the segmentation of labor. In other words, do you need your top tech over there grinding off seam sealer, getting a quarter panel ready to install? Or can you have an apprentice tech that works underneath that senior tech doing some of those tasks that allow our brain surgeon to actually do brain surgery versus actually doing all the other thing of prepping the patients and everything else? So that's where I think you start getting some opportunities, but it means we're going to have to look at changing the way we handle compensation models and things to be able to have those types of apprenticeship programs. But it could very well also extend the life cycle of some of those senior techs that you have in your shop if they're not having to have the wear and tear on their body every day of doing it all on their own.
Yeah. Real quick story, and then I want to get into your thoughts on how you think this would work. When I went to Votech, I went for diesel technology, and there was a program that had just started up. This was the first year it ever ran. It was ran by CAT, mm-hmm. The equipment company CAT. And what they did was they did 3 months of in-school training, education, that type of thing. But then every one of those students had 3 months that they worked at a shop. And they changed shop locations and all this kind of stuff. So they would focus on transmissions, and then, you know, the kids would go out to a shop and work in an actual shop environment. And even back then, I thought that was brilliant. I thought that was a great way to do something like that. And now that Votech school that I went to is almost completely reversed to where that's the main program, mm-hmm. that, or the way of being taught, versus the how I went through, which was just 2 years and all you did was just class training and that's it. So John Deere is in there doing that kind of training. Case IH is in there doing that kind of training. New Holland, CAT, they're all doing that kind of training. So do you think, I mean, apprenticeship is a little bit different than that, but do you think that's something that could work pretty well for Votech schools is to do something like that?
Well, I think one of the challenges you've had with Votech schools for years is the fact that how do you replicate what the actual business model is that you see in the industry? Yeah. You know, a lot of them you go to and you're trying to teach them basic things like how to prep and paint things. And, you know, so it's very difficult because you're not having the type of work that comes in there that you would typically see in a collision center. So even a lot of shops recruiting out of Votech schools, they start looking at the candidates with a little bit of a watchful eye to say, hey, what do they really know coming out of school? Because they've probably been restoring trucks and customizing things and all this and not really doing collision work that I would be doing in our business every day. So part of it is trying to figure out how do we make sure we replicate the model of what's going on in the collision center. I think if a lot of the vocational schools could actually just starting getting people ready for some of the basics and actually, as your point, have it transition into some sort of work-life experience where they work on a shop floor. You know, in other words, teaching the students how to do things like welding, how to actually disassemble something, how to actually prep something that would put them in a position to actually be able to go out and work in a shop as a prepper or a body tech assistant or something like that. They're going to learn more from working alongside that senior tech in a month than what they would do going to technical school for 2 years, just because of the difference in the live work that they're focusing on.
First class, auto body 101, how to push a broom. here's how you sweep a shop floor. Okay, so now I kind of want to get your thoughts on this. Has been brought up a couple of times in the podcast, and you're at a little bit of a different level. You're at a little bit of a different viewpoint than some of the other people that have come on. The having an apprenticeship type program where you have a younger tech working with an older tech, and you had brought up, you know, maybe there's a compensation model that needs to change there. In your mind, let's just throw out all politics and everything like that. If you had a shop, and it was an ideal fairy tale world, how would you see that playing out?
Well, I think you have to kind of look at it's that whole bench development piece, is you need to have a strategic plan as far as how you're going to onboard and bring people through the organization. But the problem is we're not thinking about building a strategic plan of having people that's in our organization that learn to do the things that way we want to do it. Now, there are some good shops out there that are very good at doing this. They bring in junior techs, they apprentice and train them, they learn the culture, and there's a lot more of an alignment to the goals and missions of that business because of the fact that they grew up in the business. You may go hire the hot shot from a competitor, but are they the right fit for the way your business operates? And, you know, they may or may not be. They may not do business the same way your company does business. So part of it is actually building a program in place where you can actually instill that. Now, when you talk about the compensation piece, you kind of have to look and measure out what the impact is on the compensation that the technician's going to have to do it. And you got to make sure it goes back to having the right people in the right seat. You know, just because somebody's a senior tech doesn't mean they're going to be a great teacher.
In fact, actually, it's probably really rare to find someone who's a senior tech that's, you know, actually a pretty good teacher. It's just a whole different skill set.
So you know, you kind of have to gauge who in your team has the ability to do that, who could actually benefit from having someone like that to work with, and use it as a bench development tool is what you have to do. And then you build your compensation model where it doesn't penalize the person that's teaching, but they actually benefit from some of the efficiency of having somebody help. Now, at the beginning, they may not have the efficiency, so you may have to, as a shop, you may have to be prepared to subsidize that to some degree, because you bring in somebody straight in off the street and you pair them with your senior tech, and they have to spend a lot of time initially out of the gate just teaching them basic things that they need to be doing, and it may take away from their efficiency to some degree because of that. So you may have to subsidize that some at the very beginning, but as that person becomes more proficient and they're able to do more tasks and help that person produce more hours, then you can go back and adjust the model as it goes along in a way that it doesn't penalize the person who's doing the work, you know, that's leading that process for you, leading the apprentices.
Maybe what we need is we just need something like the NFL draft, where we stick all this money into these Votech training programs and everything like that. We have a Skills USA program, and then Sherwin-Williams and PPG and whoever else just comes in, and they're like, you know, first round pick of it goes to this gentleman from wherever, you know.
Well, the only difference is, I guess, if you were to go to that model, the difference is that all the NFL, for example, gets the benefit of all the colleges essentially being would be our vocational school.
Yep.
You know, somebody goes to college for 3-4 years and under coaching and does it and learns it, then they're pretty much prepared. So it's almost like the minor leagues for them. But the challenge we've got is that minor league that we have with the colleges has not been something that's been heavily invested in the past decade. It's
probably longer.
Could be longer than that, because I
would say at least 20 years.
Yeah, it's challenging because you look at some of these programs and they can't even get the investment money to even buy the materials they need to actually teach the students. So they don't understand what the administration of some of the schools don't understand what some of these schools need to be able to be successful. And I think that's a point that we need to understand, that if we're going to change it as an industry, we have to be more involved with these schools. You know, it was great earlier this year. I saw that that the collision industry got engaged with a school counselors conference. And actually set a booth up and got involved there, because it gave them the National School Counselors Conference. It gave them an opportunity to actually talk about the industry in front of school counselors, the very people that are probably telling the students that you need to get a 4-year degree, even though they're barely passing high school, instead of talking about any technical trade opportunities they could be in. So I think part of it is kind of educating the educational area of our country a little bit about what the opportunities are around technical trades as well.
Yeah, and you know, I'll just add to that and say that I think there is a bit of a culture shift going on right now anyways with younger kids, mm-hmm. where they don't want to go to college, not because they're stupid or lazy or anything like that. It actually comes down to more that they've realized, maybe I should be careful with my words here, they look at the numbers and figure out that, you know what, this doesn't really make a lot of sense, because you graduating with just your basic degree does nothing for you anymore. Absolutely nothing. So they look at how much money it takes to get that degree and then the opportunities it provides them, which is, it's no different than if they didn't go to college in the first place. And they're like, why would I even bother in the first place? But I will tell you, dating myself here a little bit, but that's fine. I graduated in 07 from high school. And I can tell you, even back then, you know, when you would tell people like you're going to tech school, it's a little bit different here in the Midwest, because we have a little bit different, I don't know, not work ethic, but just a mindset around work. You know, blue collar is kind of a little bit more, not looked up to, but it's a little bit, white collar and blue collar kind of at the similar level, because of farmers and everything like that. But yeah, I mean, even then, like, you tell them like you're going to a 2-year college, people are kind of like, oh, okay, well, you know, have fun not making money for the rest of your life. And I'm sitting over here like, I don't know, it seems perfectly fine to me. You're going to go $60,000 to $80,000 to $100,000 in debt. I'm not. I'm going to start work. Yeah. And that's what I care about. So removing that stigma, I think is something that's kind of already getting done, but I think it's a really brutally important part of that you have to be pretty intelligent, very intelligent, to be doing a lot of these jobs. Mm-hmm. And you don't want an idiot working on your electrical.
Yeah.
because electrical starts fires.
Yeah.
You don't want an idiot plumbing your pipes, because if a pipe bursts, your house gets flooded. You know, you don't want an idiot fixing your car, because if an idiot fixes your car, it'll fall apart as you're going down the road, or kill you when you get into an accident. Like, you have to be pretty intelligent to do a lot of these things nowadays. Mm-hmm. We've kind of already come up on an hour, Ted. Any last words, thoughts, anything like that?
I think we've covered a lot of ground in what we've discussed. I think we could probably go into a lot of other topics if we wanted to, but you know, the key thing on here is that I think we have, as an industry, we just have to stay focused on building the right culture with our employees, and actually building the apprenticeship programs, and investing back in the industry. And that means not just financial investments, that means time investments. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the critical part of what we should be doing.
Before you go, real quick, just out of my own curiosity. Mm-hmm. So, Global Director of Business Services, what role or things does that entail for yourself? What are you doing for Sherwin-Williams on a global scale with that?
So the best way I can say it is that I work with all of our organizations across the globe. So I deal with all the different markets. So it gives me some insight into what's happening in other parts of the world, which you can kind of look and see some of the things that we're dealing with today. And you can look back at Europe and you can say, well, that's something the bridge they crossed 5 years ago, and you can just see the changes coming. So I get the great opportunity of that, but I focus on the internal development of our employees around how do they actually deliver value to our customers. I actually work with our customers to help them develop and grow their business and to be the survivors in the industry, the ones that not only survive but thrive. And then I work on our added value programs, and I work with strategic partners to make sure that we're able to help them achieve the goals they're trying to do. So that's a lot of stuff. But what it really comes down to is people, and helping the people be successful and delivering value to our customers, and help our customers deliver value to their customers.
Well, it seems like you're the right guy for the job. Not trying to fluff your ego again, but yeah. I would say, from what I've heard so far, they've probably got the right man sitting in the chair. Ted, I want to thank you for your time. It has been just a very enlightening and great talk, and I really do appreciate your time today.
No, you're welcome. And anytime again, if you have any more things you want to talk about, just let me know.
Awesome. All well, right. I hope you have a good rest of the day.
You do same. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Auto Body Podcast, presented by Clarity Code. Our passion is to talk to and about anyone in the industry, from painters, body guys, manufacturers, and anyone in between. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Make sure to like, rate, and review. And we'll be back soon. But in the meantime, visit us at claritycoat.com and find us on Facebook and YouTube at Clarity Coat. See you next time on the Auto Body Podcast.